Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
So this week, we're going to start off with atomic clocks and redefining the second.
Yeah, indeed. I had disappeared there for a second. There we go. I'm back. So how do we measure time is the question here that we're asking, I guess. And we have now found out that we can measure it ridiculously, ridiculously accurately. So we use as our basis of time a thing called the second, which everyone is familiar with. And that is one of the what is called SI units. And so there are seven SI units. There are units for mass, time, electric current, luminous intensity, amount of substance, temperature, and length. So the meter and the mole and the ampere and all those sorts of things that you heard of before. So somehow those things have to be defined because there's no sort of absolute definition of these things. So at the moment, the definition of the second is, wait for it, the duration of 9,192,631,770 periods of the radiation corresponding to the transition between the two hyperfine levels of the ground state of the cesium-133 atom, which tells you a lot.
That tells me nothing.
Okay, so basically what is happening here is that we're looking at a process that occurs in a particular type of atom, which we can measure to great precision. And by great precision, we're talking about 16 figures here. That's pretty precise.
And that's very precise.
It is very precise, but we can do even better, which is what has recently been discovered. Now, obviously, it's really, really important to be able to measure time to extraordinary precision. And I guess the example that's often used here is when you're thinking about sort of orbiting satellites and stuff like that. And the fact that they are moving so quickly that the theory of relativity starts playing or starts being important there. And if your satellites are moving at particular speeds and everything, all your GPS and all of that sort of stuff can be affected by the theory of relativity, and that time moves slower when you're traveling rapidly, all that sort of stuff. And so, it's important that we both define the second really, really precisely, and that we are able to measure time really, really precisely. So there's a bunch of people who make it their job to do this sort of stuff, and they have got the best acronym in the world because they work at BACON, which is the don't mention peanut butter, the Boulder Atomic Clock Optical Network. And so, as I say, the current definition of the second dates from around about 1967. And as I say, what we're looking at is this very, very rapid process that occurs in an atom. And this process occurs in what we call the microwave frequency. Okay, and you all know about microwaves and stuff. Now, what these folk in Colorado have done now is to extend this to the optical frequency, and the optical frequency is around about 100,000 times more rapid than microwave frequency, and this can then make measurements more precise, more accurate. And so what these workers have done now is that they have made atomic clocks. Don't ask me how, because I haven't got a bloody clue. But they've made atomic clocks now, not using the cesium atom, but they've used aluminium, strontium, and ytterbium atoms. The latter two you're probably not necessarily familiar with. And what they need to do is to measure the ratios of the particular frequencies that these processes are occurring in the atoms. Okay, and that's the important thing, because they're going to use then as the basis of their time, as the basis of their second. And so they've measured essentially the ratios of these very, very fast atomic processes that are occurring, and they've found now that they can measure them down to around about 10 to the minus 18. So that's now 18 figures in your definition, essentially, of a second, which means that you have increased the precision now by a factor of 100, which is, you know, quite amazing. And what they've found is that they can utilize these clocks sort of talking to each other over both optical fibers and also just straight through the atmosphere as well. And that's going to be important because, you know, relativity is important, you know, so the clocks have to show the same time, all that sort of stuff. So if they can then communicate with each other at this sort of precision, then, you know, that's all good for the future of timekeeping and stuff, and may well lead to the redefinition of what we understand by a second now. A couple of years ago, they redefined what the kilogram is, you know, these base units and the SI units. And so it may well be that at some stage in the future, they now look at redefining what the second is in terms of the more precise gear that they can now use to be able to measure this stuff. So, you know, it's quite incredible stuff. And you might think, well, you know, what's the point? Well, it's all about measurement. And, you know, science is all about measurement. And basically, the more precisely we can measure things, the better we know science, the better we can understand things. And certainly, you know, testing things like the theory of relativity and stuff like that, that takes extraordinarily sensitive timepieces and stuff. And also fundamental constants of the universe. You know, we need to know their values very, very precisely because we can use those to measure other things and everything. So quite impressive science, this, and doubtless comes with an enormous price tag.
I was going to say, does this impact me or you or anyone else?
Not obviously, but then again, as I was saying with the whole GPS thing and your satellites and all that sort of stuff, not obviously in your day-to-day life, but it does have an impact somewhere along the line, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to our next topic today, we're talking about golden balls and gravity.
The smallest object to have its gravity measured.
Indeed. And there comes a question, what the heck is gravity? Because we are all familiar with it. We know it exists. Every time you fall over, that's gravity in action. But how does it work? How is it manifested? What, quote unquote, transmits gravity? And that was a question that first was, I guess, investigated way back by Newton, way back in the 17th century. And then Einstein came along sort of with a theory of gravity, and he sort of explained gravity in terms of the fact that big masses, or any mass, in fact, would warp space-time. So this is where we get into our four-dimensional view of the universe, so three spatial coordinates and a time coordinate, and then you put a great mass in there and it sort of warps it, and you sort of think about that as being sort of a big mass in the middle of a rubber sheet or something. You place that on it and it warps that rubber sheet, and then if you put something else on there, then it'll be attracted to that mass. And, you know, that's one of the simple ways of explaining the way that gravity works. But, you know, it's been proposed that there are things called gravitons, these particles that mediate gravitational exchange between masses. And this is all heavy physics and everything, and I'm not going to go there necessarily, but very interestingly, these bunch of workers in Vienna have in the last couple of weeks published a paper in Nature talking about measuring the gravitational field, if you will, of the smallest object that has yet had their gravitational field measured. And this was a gold ball, a gold sphere, weighing about 90 milligrams, okay? And what they did was that they would put this close to another little gold sphere weighing about the same mass that was sort of suspended on this pendulum-like thing that could sort of was free to rotate around a very, very thin wire. And they were looking for the gravitational effects of bringing these balls close together. Now, if we tried to do that just, you know, sort of, I guess, holding two little gold balls in our hands, you wouldn't feel a thing. You know, the effect obviously is very, very small. Gravity, despite the fact that when you fall over it hurts like hell, gravity is in fact a very, very weak force in the grand scheme of things. So it's difficult to measure gravitational effects of very small objects. And the reason for that is essentially the fact that you've got all of these other competing forces, I guess, that you have to then get rid of before you can find gravitational forces manifesting themselves. So things like matter, Okay, so other pieces of matter can exert forces and stuff like that. So you have to do experiments like this in a very, very, very good vacuum to make sure that there's no other matter floating around. You've got electrostatic forces that could be important, and so therefore you have to shield everything very, very well in a Faraday cage, so make sure there's no sort of stray electrostatic forces that could be affecting your readings. Temperature, obviously, thermal effects, so things can attract each other differently at different temperatures, so you've got to do everything very, very well thermostated conditions. Seismic effects, so you know the Earth itself is not stationary and stuff, so you've always got these little earthquakes going on and stuff like that, so somehow you have to, you know, damp your whole experiment so that you can get rid of those possible effects. And in fact, what these guys in Vienna did was that they ran the experiments over Christmas time because there weren't so many people around then. And so, you know, the mere seismic effect of, you know, just people just walking around, cars in the street, that sort of thing, were minimized. Even sound can make a difference. You know, we're talking very, very, very small effects here. So you have to completely isolate your experiment. It's a very, very difficult experiment to do. But they have done it. And what they found was that their results completely concurred with the results of both Newton and Einstein. And what Newton said was that the force, the gravitational force between two objects, decreases very, very rapidly. It decreases as 1 over the square of the distance between them. So it's a squared or an inverse squared law, which means that it really, really drops off hugely. And you have to bring these things very, very close together in order to be able to show that they are exhibiting a force. So this gravitational force, this attractive force between them. So this is a very, very nice piece of science. And again, it's further confirmation of the fact that, you know, Newton had it right all of those many, many years ago on the big scale, and then Einstein also has it right, you know, when it comes down to the sort of the very small scale and stuff. And if you go much smaller scale than this, then things start getting very, very complicated, because then you start getting quantum effects and stuff like that. And you really, really don't want to go there. So
that's crazy.
So it is, you're absolutely right. It is, yeah. Crazy, but you know, people are doing it, and it's all good stuff.
So we had a question come in.
Oh,
and
geez.
They were asking, why are they getting the question so accurate when they could just make it longer so that we don't have to tack on an extra day every 4 years for leap year?
No, but that is the fact that we've got the Earth going around the sun, and so therefore that is not necessarily a constant process, and also the Earth rotating on its own axis and stuff like that. So there's just sort of slight, I guess, infelicities in that whole process, and so that's what leads to the fact that you've got to add on a second or whatever, because it doesn't quite... I see the point that they're making, but you know, the second has already been defined. What was it? They originally defined it as 1/86,400th of a day, because there's 86,400 seconds in a day. And then they found that that wasn't quite right, because it didn't quite line up with how quickly the Earth was going around the sun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or the rotation of the Earth. So everything, you know, all of these originally come back to the rotation around the Earth. Rotation around the sun.
Okay, and then lastly, we were looking at Richard Pearse.
Richard Pearse, absolutely. He is a great New Zealander, and he was the first person to fly. Heavier than air. Yeah. Powered flight. Richard Pearse. You haven't heard of him?
Suck on that, Wright Brothers.
Yeah, no, exactly. And on the 31st of March, which is today, 1903, he supposedly had the first... powered heavier than air flight. And this is a place called Waitohi, which is down in South Canterbury, just outside Temuka. And so the real tragedy of all of this is that everything was not particularly well documented in the day. And there were around about 48 eyewitness accounts of Richard Pearse actually flying, almost definitely during the year 1903-1904. So he was certainly contemporaneous with the Wright brothers. A lot of people are damn sure that it was 1903, because they had a big snow in Canterbury in 1903, and they remember this being just prior to the big snow. Now, as I say, this didn't sort of make big news in the papers. It wasn't well documented. Pierce himself gave up on all of this at around about 1911 or so, and he went down to live in South Otago, and really, really tragically, he ended up in a mental asylum, and he died in a mental asylum in 1953. And he became awfully paranoid and everything, and thought that everyone was after his work and stuff. And so his papers, or many of his papers and stuff, had been destroyed, presumably by him. And it was really only after his death that people started investigating the work that he had done. And there's absolutely no doubt he was a genius. He was absolutely brilliant. He built his own engines for his plane. So this was just, you know, he had no formal training as an engineer or anything like that. He built his own engines, and he was responsible for the concept of ailerons, or flaps on the wings. So, you know, you put your flaps down and you go up, you know, you see them on your planes every time you take off and stuff. Those were his inventions. And, you know, this complete novice, you know, with no formal scientific training or anything like that, he's just one of the great New Zealanders. And it is such a tragedy that we will never know whether or not he did beat the Wright brothers to this. But the reason that I'm talking about it today is because supposedly the 31st of March 1903, that was the day that he took flight, flew about 120 to 150 yards, according to the eyewitnesses, and he ended up crashing into a hedge.
Well, let's hope that we have time travel soon and we can go and find out.
Maybe next week on Dear Science.
Yeah.
Indeed, fair enough.
Sweet. Yeah. Okay, so that's all we've got for Dear Science this week. Thank you so much, Alan.
Always a pleasure, you guys.
Sweet.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. So